Tom Luongo, producer of Gold Goats and Guns newsletter. Welcome to The Competent Investor. How are you?
I am good, Mr. Bodrovics. How are you? How have you been? We haven't seen each other or talked to each other since May, to be honest with you, when we saw each other open corners.
It's been really busy. Right. For me, I mean, obviously this was a very quick transition for me that was very unexpected, but you know, life throws you curveballs sometimes, and that's okay. Yep. I'm grateful for people like you that I still have contact with, that I can still, you know, build with and build off of, as well as an excellent audience that has an appetite for hopefully more objective, or, you know, just a different way of thinking about all of these happenings in the world. And it's never been more important to try and make sense of all of this stuff. Right.
No, I agree completely. And it is interesting. You know, I remember when I first got summarily let go at Newsmax, which is the inciting incident for what happened now, which is why Gold Goats and Guns exists, right? I got an email that wound up in my spam folder saying, "Hey, we no longer need you're done." It's about the most unprofessional way one can get fired. It was not, you know, I don't put it honestly on Newsmax as an organization. It was the guy who was actually running the department at the time. He's no longer there. Like, it's, you know, it's not a big deal. You know, I understood what the problem was. I could kind of see it coming anyway, that they were in a position where they needed to make some serious changes. And I just said, okay, well, thank you. I, you know, reached out to Chris Ruddy, thanked him for giving me the opportunity, and was able to stay close enough to the organization through my other contacts with them, and, you know, got through it. And by the end of that summer, we launched Gold Goats and Guns, and, you know, that was that. And then we just worked until where we are today. So, all I can say is that, you know, I wish for you the same level of success, and, you know, just stick with it. You know, so it's hard when that happens, right? But it's also really important to realize that, you know, when that happened to me, the first thing I did was not get angry. I was shocked, right? But I didn't get angry. The first thing I did was I bore right down and said, I can do this. You know, no problem. I just sat down and figured out how I could do it. I looked at all the people that I thought I knew, and I knew, and I said, okay, how am I going to get this done? I had like four people, and, you know, I leveraged them as I could, and I, you know, and we went from there. It was hard, but I did it. So there it is.
I think that's maybe an interesting place to start as well, Tom, is kind of talking a little bit about your relationship with Dexter. You know, I had the fortune of meeting and spending time with both of you. You know, we hear so much about Dexter kind of behind the scenes. You know, you guys have made an effort to do a little bit more in public together. But, you know, as you said, making that transition with Dexter, what do you think are the biggest things that you guys maybe disagree upon?
Ooh, that's a good question. It's a very good question, and it's actually a very easy question to answer because we talk about it all the time. So Dexter believes that things are a lot more stochastic than I do, meaning a lot more random than I think they are. Whereas I tend to like to, you know, generate linear narratives and sell those linear narratives on podcast after podcast. And at which point sometimes those linear narratives fall apart because, you know, we all have fungible information or whatever. So that's what we wind up arguing about more than anything else. Is I put forth some idea or some narrative, or I see a whole bunch of, we see all the same things, and I order them up in a particular way because that's the way I like to see cause and effect. Whereas he tends to see things as more of a, well, hey, you know, don't let a good opportunity go to waste. Don't let a good crisis go to waste. That's his general, you know, argument for what happens in the post something. You know, so we have a traumatic or, you know, tremendous event, Charlie Kirk getting assassinated. And then we watch, you know, and then you have two different stories that could easily be out there. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go pick two or three potential reasons why the shooting occurred, and who was incentivized for it, and then write write some fan fiction. No life, write some fan fiction, and then see if it fits with the facts. Where meanwhile, Dexter does something completely different, which is to say, Occam's razor is probably this. And what we're seeing now is a lot of ad hoc response to it that looks like it's generative, and looks like it was self-existent or pre-existing. And he's not, and I'll be honest with you, it's usually an amalgam of both perspectives, right? He has to like come towards me and go, yeah, there's a clear chain of command in this thing somewhere, but then these other things that we're seeing are completely random, and then we're watching. And so then we're watching how those play themselves out. And so we wind up with this very interesting amalgam of those two perspectives over time. And what that's actually done over the course of the nine years that we've been doing Gold, Ghosts, and Guns, this is about 8 years, this is the beginning of year nine, is realizing that we're both really right about the same amount of stuff, right? And in that respect, and there is a much higher respect level than there was previously, because we both brought receipts to those two different perspectives.
Yeah.
Multiple times. I've been right about certain things I'm more inductive and he's more deductive in terms of our reasoning, right? I have a much more, I think I really do have a much more like flexible inductive brain where I go, no, sorry, I know what that is. And he's like, no, he sees something and then he has to spend 4 hours trying to figure out if it's true or not. And I don't have any patience for that. I let the world eventually tell me whether my initial instinct was correct or not. And every time that I've been told I shouldn't trust my initial instinct, I wound up being wrong. And so now I just really trust that spidey sense, whatever you want to call it. I'm like, no, I think that's it. And then I'll sit down and I'll play out some confounding ideas or some conflicting ideas just to steel man stuff. And then I wound up like, no, I was right originally. You know, that initial take was more right than everything else. And then eventually then you fill in the details and you go from there. So, yeah, I think that that's a very, that's a good summation of the two of us and the way we operate in different idioms.
So let's take that example, Tom, if you wouldn't mind, the assassination of Charlie Kirk in your, let's say your framework, where, what do you think that catalyst is the inciting point to like what is the end game of that inciting incident?
Oh yeah, that's a very good question. So by the way, I am until proven otherwise, I'm going with the official story. And I know that's going to disappoint a lot of people in the audience who want to go down a whole bunch of rabbit holes that, you know, he was shot by a guy with a finger gun, you know. Yeah, I just don't buy it. So I also don't buy that it was 30-06. Maybe, I don't know. There was a 30-06 shot because I heard it. I'm like, that's 30-06 or that's 308. That's like, they're basically the same thing. But the downstream effect was to be a warning to Donald Trump. It could be a stochastic bit of violence, right? Stochastic random event that burbled up out of the zeitgeist that was set in motion, that something was eventually going to burble up out of this. And eventually we were going to get this event. Eventually someone was going to take a shot at Charlie Kirk and they were going to be successful at it. And then you just watch everybody, you know, use that event for their own purposes. That's what I think has been happening since then. I also believe at a certain level that Tyler Robinson was probably being, for lack of a better term, groomed in order to get him to the point where he would do that. So they were increased. So whoever was wanting to send that message. Okay. Now you can also believe, and I'm perfectly, again, I am going with this particular incident or this particular framework, but it does not matter if you disagree with me or not. It does not matter. What matters is it's clearly was a message being sent by whomever. And my personal opinion, I think that's, I think it's the king. I think it's Davos. I think it's whoever you want to put it yourself in that framework, because they're the ones that have the most to gain from this. They have the incentive structure. So they're clearly involved at some level. We may never know what the truth is, but the search for the truth is actually the distraction. What matters is the message that was sent. And I think, as always, the goal is chaos. And I don't mean just general chaos. I mean a very specific kind of chaos. And it's the kind of chaos, from an investor perspective, you need to understand, which is this. Everything that Donald Trump is doing at a domestic level, every single thing he is doing, is to recapitalize the middle class of the United States. Because the way you stop the stochastic violence of Tyler Robinson, this is why I actually prefer to look at it this way, because this is a thing that Trump is trying to solve, okay? And we're going to see a whole bunch of stochastic violence and a whole bunch of directed violence that's going to look like stochastic violence, and we're not going to be able to tell the two apart. But we have to stop that by giving people hope. We have to stop that by stopping the revolutionary impulse that comes from taking away people's access to the wealth and capital formation system, which is what we have. Okay. And that's why Fannie and Freddie need to come out of conservatorship and need to be relisted. That's why, you know, the government needs to be cut in half. That's why these things need to occur. And everything Donald Trump is doing, and Scott Bessent, and yes, even Jerome Powell, what they're doing is setting that stuff in motion. And the people behind them, mostly Wall Street, are going to get paid, both rightfully and wrongfully, for the things that the assets that they have. And I'm speaking specifically to their positions and their complicity in what happened to Fannie and Freddie back in 2008, and how they're going to profit from it when it goes to IPO. But we have to create a process by which the kids of today, like my 19-year-old daughter, feel like they have the possibility and the option to earn enough money, buy a starter home, to start a family, and to be able to be a part of that system. And in the wake of COVID inflation and 15 years of zero bound interest rates and, you know, unbelievable inflation and housing and everything else, and all physical assets and rents out of control because private equity is buying up the houses and then jacking the rents up to 3 times the other rate and blah, 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 blah. All that stuff, every goddamn bit of it, has made them feel like they don't have any skin in the game. And those are very dangerous people, because they're going to be seduced by the siren's call of the unquenchable envy of Marxism on the one side, or they're going to chuckle and collapsitarian on the nihilistic libertarian sovereign individualist right. Neither of those things are healthy for a civilization. They are both, at the end of the day, because the political spectrum is not a line but a circle, they're exactly the same thing. And both of those things have nihilism at their core, and they're anti-civilization. And my libertarian brethren need to get their heads out of their left brain dominant asses and realize exactly where they are, because they are part of the problem. Now, I'm talking specifically to, I can name them all because they're all on Twitter and I'm starting to block every one of them. Daniel McAdams, Chris Rossini, I can name them all. They're all wrong. Every freaking one of them. Rand Paul, Thomas Massey, all of them. They're all wrong. It's what I ran into when I was at the Mises Institute this time last year. And I'm watching them purity spiral into irrelevance. Good. Hopefully they will never darken the political shores ever again, because when they were called upon to serve the society that they say they want, they chose not to. We know the Marxists are going to act that way, because that's implicit, explicit in their ideology. But even the hardcore libertarian right, even they're gone. They don't get it. They don't understand that it's like reading David Stockman every day or any of these guys. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, you get up in the morning and you try to reinterpret everything Donald Trump is doing is wrong. How are you indistinguishable from Chuck Schumer?
Well,
how are you different from Chuck Schumer? You're not objective. You're completely subjective at this point.
Tom, explain to me a little bit about why you say that they didn't serve their country. They didn't act when they needed to act. What do you mean by that?
Like, what do I mean by that? Well, they let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Donald Trump is not perfect. Scott Bessent's plans are not perfect. There's going to be some authoritarianism in all of their plans. They're going to have to do, like, these are the same people that have been looking at looking to Vladimir Putin over in Russia and seeing how he saved Russia and going, and then seeing that Trump is literally just like running the same playbook, but Trump is evil and a dictator, but Putin is, you know, a great guy. Like, excuse me, but the way Putin saved Russia was to nationalize whole industries that were in the hands of globalists, handing that money and power back to the people, liberalizing the power of the presidency. He used the unbelievable power of the Russian president. You think our president is powerful? Forget it. The Russian president has had 10 times more power than our president does. He had to do all of that, put the oligarchs back in the box, and literally take control of the country and act in many ways like an authoritarian dictator, where, and I'm okay, and I'm not going to say I'm okay with that. He used the power of the presidency to create Russia as a country, and now he's backing off by deliberalizing. I mean, the last thing they went through in 2019 was to liberalize and devolve power out of the presidency, some into the Duma, some into the state councils, you know, all this stuff. And Alexander Mercurius and I covered this in great detail back in 2019, 2020, when it was happening. We did podcasts on it on my show. I did podcasts on his show. We talked about it at great length back then. So for those of you coming into the middle of the conversation, if you look at what Donald Trump is doing, like, the libertarians are being knee-jerk and they're saying, well, he's taking a 10% stake in Intel. He's nationalizing Intel. That's authoritarian. Well, yeah, it is, but it's also necessary, because we don't have a country right now. Okay, we don't. We have an open border. We have 100,000 people dying of fentanyl overdoses every year. We've got governors that are in open freaking revolt against the federal government. We've got all these things that are happening. We've got an entire generation of kids that don't even feel like they care about whether America lives or dies or not at this point. Maybe two generations, if not two and a half generations. And you think we have a country? You think this is good for civilization, that we're like fighting each other in the streets over who gets their order at Five Guys before the other guy? Like, are you out of your minds? Like, this is where we are. So, like, we have a lot of work to do. And at times you're going to have to accept the fact that we're just at war, and we've already been aggressed to the point of and pushed to the breaking point. That means you're allowed to, oh, by the way, utilize the non-aggression principle to say, yeah, I've been aggressed. I'm going after you bastards. Like, I'm sorry, the non-aggression principle is not a suicide pact for pacifism. And anybody who argues that point is a fucking traitor. Period. They're a fucking traitor at this point. Like, I'm sorry. Like, that's the way it is. And when you put it into the context of the great game of geopolitics, you realize that that impulse is being used against you. That interpretation is being used against you to advance the agenda of those who are trying to destroy the country. And that's why when they were called to fucking serve last fall, to go be a part of the Trump administration and be influential, they all sat on their hands and they went home, because they're nice and happy being critics, but they have no desire to be architects. And we have to have all we can have at this point. We don't want too many architects, because architects are not going to consider the criticism of how you go about building the building, right? And we can't have just critics, because critics have no skin in the game and don't want to actually build anything. They just want to sit back and, oh, well, I'm, you know, no, that's wrong. Yeah, that's bad. 2 stars. Worst, you know, worst government ever. 0 out of 10. And make a Yelp out of every fucking thing. You have to have both critic and architect. We all have to embody the idea of being both the critic and the architect at the same time, and understand that there's going to be compromises made, and that freedom is a process, and that moving, getting and building civilization is a process, so we can get to the point where we get back to that high trust society that they're all arguing we should have. But that high trust society is a consequence of people doing honest to God things against animals and orcs that are literally trying to rape your children and destroy your communities. What are you going to do about it? Just say, well, that I can't do anything about it? Like, no, you're going to empower the fucking cops to go at assholes and elbows with freaking Tonfas and stun guns and put these people in their fucking place. Mm-hmm. I know this. I watched my dad do it. My dad was NYPD. He was out there on the streets the night in Bedford-Stuyvesant, the night Martin Luther King got shot. And what did he do? He didn't arrest those guys that were rioting. He beat them when they were beating somebody else and saved the innocent. That's his job. Every friggin' arrest means that you got to take a cop off the streets. They know that. George Soros knows that. That's why these guys aren't getting arrested. They're just getting beaten and dropped in the streets and moving on, because that's effective policing. Like it or not, folks, but they're the ones rioting in the friggin' streets. They're the ones lighting off Molotov cocktails. They're already violent. They've already given up their civil rights. This is not hard. This is what men are supposed to do. This is what Pete Hegseth's speech was about the other day. And we have to get comfortable with that. We have to get comfortable with that level of violence and meet violence with violence. And but we meet violence with violence that's proportional to what we've been given. And we give them every opportunity to say, you know what? You don't have to do this. Come back from the fold. Stop it. Stop being who you stop it. And submit.
And be reminded that there should be consequences for your actions, because that I think that's a like part and parcel of this time that we've come into, because there's no consequences for your actions, right?
No, there isn't. Yeah. I mean, in many ways, that is completely correct. So you know, as parents, it's important that we teach our children, you know, that if you want to do that thing, well, you're gonna have to live with the consequence of it. Oh, I got hurt. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying like, you know, I'll allow your kid to stick a fork in an electric socket. That's just dumb. But, you know, that's the extreme level of that. But, you know, let them go out and, you know, run around with no shoes on in the front yard and go, oh, God, ow, that hurt. Like, yeah, maybe you should put some shoes on.
Yeah.
Maybe shoes, you know, and if you still don't want to put shoes on, then maybe you should be more careful in how you run. Just kind of what I do. I live a hobbit's life with no, if I put shoes on, it's not, you know, I have to deal with the duck shit on a daily basis, right? Dodging the duck shit, which is why I walk with my head down all the time. But that being said, like, okay, that's a little TMI, but you know, it is what it is. But you know, have some understand that there's consequences for your behavior. Your behavior, you do not just get to go out into the streets. And this is part of the reason why I've always had a problem. You know, like in my old days as a hardcore anarcho theorist or anarcho cap, whatever you want to call it, I used to sit down. I used to think about how the law interfaced with actual human behavior in a very, very, you know, realistic way. Like, you can always look at a law as a limit on what people's behavior is, but you can also look at it as a limit to what people are allowed to do to aggress somebody else without consequence. There's two sides to the line. The libertarian always wants to look at it as a limit on their behavior, because the government is, you know, pointing a gun at me arbitrarily and saying, you can't do that. You can't drive the 55 mile an hour speed limit, for example. But at the same time, you also have to realize that also means that people can drive up to that limit. Now, for the most part, the 55 mile an hour speed limit is dumb. But now let's talk about some other stupid rule, like pollution or pick a thing. It allows people, here's one for you. Pedestrians have the right of way in the road. It's a law. You can't, cars have to, by definition, have to defer to pedestrians in the road, which is why these little bastards can go out and sit in the middle of the freaking road holding signs, wearing orange vests, and the people have to stop. Because so now they've taken that behavior all the way to the limit where the law was not meant to do that. The law was meant to protect civilians and have create a clear line of fault for when a person ran into a pedestrian with their car. Mm-hmm. The car driver is always in the wrong. They then turned around and violated the spirit of that rule and ordered that law in order to then use it to shut down the entire fucking society. At which point I'm with the guy in the BMW who turned around and revved his engine and, you know, turned the car around and blew, you know, exhaust on the guy sitting in the road. If you've ever seen that video, like, that's the way you deal with those people. And then you just, I'm going to just burn a whole bunch of gas and I don't have a muffler on this freaking thing. Get the fuck out of my way. And then back down the road and get out of there. Like, at the end of the day, the cops should move those people. So clearly the cops aren't moving them because the cops are complicit, because the cops have been replaced. They're anti-civilizational. So at that point, everybody at that point in that situation that's being, I don't care what the law says at that point. The law's in the wrong. These people are in the wrong. You go out there and you pick them up and you throw them out of the way. And if they start just climbing back into the middle of the road, you beat the fuck out of them and then put them on the side of the road so they can't come back into the middle of the road. Because you're clearly acting in a way that is obstructionist to people on a right of way. Fuck you. Gone. You are now going to the hospital. Period. And if you want to empower lawyers at that point to fine, go for it. And any rational judge is going to throw the case out. And the mayor, if the mayor was not also compromised to give in to this communist bullshit and this anti-civilizational bullshit, would say, yeah, we're not enforcing that rule. Or, oh, by the way, directive to the police department, we're suspending that rule about pedestrians in the streets. We're changing that rule. We're suspending it. No, get these people, clear these people off the streets. You know, needs of the many outweigh needs of the few. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I'll, you know, that's it. And I don't care if my libertarian brethren think I'm a fascist.
So, Tom, let's go back to kind of
like for unfiltered Tom. Yep. Tom, like, no, there you go.
It's fine. Let's go back to kind of talking about the, let's say, the what's actually happening in the world as a as a function of this. Of this change, of this pushback, you know, you mentioned Trump's visit with the king earlier. Mm-hmm. What do you think that his, like the timing of that situation, and then literally, I think it was the day after the subsequent recognition of Palestine, that timing by, you know, the recognition by the UK, Australia, Canada, Portugal, France, literally the day after, is there something more that more there because of that, the timing of it?
Yeah, no, they, this, it was very obvious that from the beginning, when you go back now in retrospect, that Keir Starmer offering a second visit to the state visit to Trump, and they tried to get it done in July and Trump then put them off, which I thought was hilarious, by the way. Oh, by the way, yeah, I'll meet with the king on my time. Right. So, which was point number one, that he and the king don't see eye to eye. Okay. And then the second thing is, yeah, so he goes and meets with the king. I think he offered terms of surrender to the crown for the 250-year war that they've been prosecuting against the United States. The king said no, because he's a good globalist cuck, or he is what he is. I don't care. Pick your poison as to what faction Charles actually represents. He could be wearing multiple hats when it comes to this. I don't care. It does not matter. Most likely it's just WEF Davos, you know, garden variety globalist stuff. He could also just be a captured pawn on the game board, but he's clearly said no, because then they turn around the very next day and everybody then recognizes the state of Palestine. Like, really? Like, what is that about? Like, there is no Palestine. There is no government in Palestine. There is no nothing. Like, we're, you know, the people in the Donbass have been fighting for their independence against the Ukrainians for 10 years, and you people can't even begin to think about recognizing them. They held referendums, they held votes, they held they didn't engage in terrorism, folks, like until the Ukrainians engaged in terrorism against them. So, like, the whole thing was clearly just a political operation to make Donald Trump look bad and to, as always with those people, wrap themselves in the moral high ground, because they've already defined the whole Israel-Gaza thing as Israel bad, Gaza good. Now, I'm not saying in any way, manner, shape, or form that I think Israel is the good guys here. I think they're both bad guys. I think Hamas is a bunch of horrible fucking people that kill human, that kill Israelis. I think they're backed by the freaking British. I think they're, you know, I think there's wings of Hamas that are clearly in the pay of the British. I think the British have got the Israelis on the other side, and I think that their ants being shaken up in the jar, as our friend Alex Craner would like to point out, and get them to fight amongst themselves, and then they can then start turning one side into the bad guy versus the other, which is clearly what they've done. This is not to say that the Israelis have not made it easy for them to do that. They clearly have. Mm-hmm. So go, you know, so salt all of this to taste, and then ask yourself, why are the Israelis doing this? And then there's 100 different answers that you could possibly give to all that. At the end of the day, it's not really that important. But what is important is that doing that was meant one, to kind of one also break down, potentially break down the Abraham Accords, as well as insert themselves dominantly into, as a dominant player, into whatever outcome is going to occur when Donald Trump tells the Israelis that's enough, which he's already done, right? So now they want to be in charge of that, and they want to wrap themselves in the moral high ground, just like they've done on Ukraine, just like they've done on every other damn thing that they've ever done, because this is the way these people operate. They're the most vile, venal people on the planet who back drug trafficking and human trafficking and everything else, and drink babies' blood and all the rest of this crap. And these are the people then wrap themselves in the moral high ground over the freaking Palestinians? Really? Like, as everybody's like, what about, you know, the stuff going on in Africa? What about the stuff going on in Southeast Asia? Like, you know, people are getting genocided every freaking day on this planet. Nobody gives a crap. But all of a sudden, the Palestinians matter. And they're the only thing that matters. Like, how about the people in, you know, in Ohio that are, I've got walking dead areas of Ohio that desperately need some freaking help. And it would be nice if, like, Europe wanted to give the United States, who's supposedly broke, by the way, some help, like, rehabilitating Ohio. But apparently that's not going to happen either. Like, all of this crap that you hear on a day-to-day basis is all such self-serving nonsense. It's all just self-serving nonsense. I can't stomach it anymore. You know, and so that's what I think is going on there. I mean, clearly. And then right after that, so we have that. Then we have the Palestinian thing. And then the next day, Trump turns around and nukes the H-1B visa program, which was another way of saying, oh, by the way, you. Because the H-1B visa program is I will go to my grave on this one. It's again another one of these stupid City of London, king-backed, you know, bad programs designed to replace Americans with foreigners in high-paying jobs. Like, the great replacement theory is true. Off to say that it's not. That's like saying the sky's not freaking blue on a day-to-day basis. Like, what are you kidding me? Like, these people lie so freaking often about everything that when they say the sun rises in the east, I have to actually go freaking check, right? So Trump nuking H-1B was basically saying, hey, that's enough. The invasion of Indians into our unskilled Indians into our country, stealing jobs from white people, is over. It's done. Forget it. Stop. And now that has direct ties back to London, because it's clearly obvious that London has been driving this, let's replace all the world leaders with Indians that we control in corporate boards, CEO positions, middle management, mayorships, this, that, everywhere else. I mean, you think it's just Sadiq Khan? Like, go through the whole list. Nadella at Microsoft, when they replaced Jack Dorsey, they replaced him with, I mean, go through every, it's every freaking where. 75% of Canadian trucking companies are now owned by freaking Sikhs.
Like, is it higher than that?
Everywhere. Yeah.
I thought it was like 83 or something like that.
Is it even higher than that? Oh my God. The last number I heard was 75. Okay. That was 6 months ago. So, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's even worse than that. And they're importing how many hundreds of thousands of Indians into Canada every day? You know, they want to double the population of Canada in the next 5 years. Why? Because they want to create an unstable system on the northern border to constantly harass the United States with a, you know, an endless stream of poo coming across the northern border. I'm sorry, that's just where I am. And I'm, you know, like, yeah, that's nice. And the worst part about it is that every Indian who's come over to the United States on, you know, honestly, feels exactly the same way I did. Like, the same people that represent the honest immigrant impulse that my parents and my grandparents, my grandparents went through as Italians, or the Irish, or the various waves of immigration to the United States. All these people, they left India, they left Italy, they left Ireland in order to come to America to seek their fortune. They sought that fortune, they made that fortune, and then they assimilated into the middle class. No one here, and the same thing's happening in Canada. These people are not assimilating. Like, it's ridiculous. And we're supposed to treat them exactly the same. We're supposed to treat both classes of people exactly the same way? No, of course not. So it's just, I'm like, no, absolutely not. Assholes and elbows, send in the military, send in ICE, send them all in, get them all out of the country. We've got 30 million people who live here who should not be here. That's it. And I don't care if that causes a housing crisis. And I don't care if that causes, you know, I don't care about any of that stuff because we've got 30 million kids. We got 30 million people in the United States, or we got, you know, 10, we got 10, 15 million, you know, young people in their young, they're in their 30s now who are still living with their parents.
Yeah.
So no, they're going to come in and they're going to buy those homes, you know, and we're going to, you know, we're going to relist Fannie and Freddie. We're going to give them good terms in order to get them in those homes. And we can start recapitalizing the middle class. And of course, that's not going to be allowed. I'm serious. Like, they're going to try and like secede like 15 states in the union in the next like 6 months. I'm dead serious, Tom. They're going to try this. And I also think that Trump is going to deploy the military all across the United States and start arresting governors. So it's going to be hilarious, frankly. But that's where I am. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Walk me through the Fannie and Freddie IPO and why this is, you know, why this needs to happen and why it's so different under Trump's guidance, right?
Yeah, well, it's there's a couple of things, and the more I study what happened in 2008, the more I realize that they stole Fannie and Freddie from the people. They took the companies and put them into conservatorship with the intention of never letting them out of conservatorship, and then they were just going to use them as a piggy bank forever. And raise the requirements for getting a mortgage in the United States for the middle class to a point where they can't actually get decent mortgages, because the goal is, again, if you have to start thinking about this in terms of the big broad picture, which is the following: the GSEs were created by Franklin Roosevelt in order to give a very favorable terms to the middle class to get access to a long-term mortgage at, you know, good rates, that where the, but with the inner, with the GSE standing as the intermediary to help offset the bank's time risk of loaning people money for 30 years, right? And the goal of that was to get people into homes, build families, build businesses that could, you know, that could produce a higher ROI than the interest rate on their mortgage. So if you're, you know, you're in a mortgage, like my dad was, in a mortgage at when the house I grew up in, $28,000 for at 3% or something like that, right? So my dad wasn't an entrepreneur; he was a cop. But if he was an entrepreneur, he could go out and start like, you know, a freaking tire shop, or, you know, pick a lawn business, HVAC business, or whatever. And if that business was able to make more than 3% a year in profit, well, then the business is paying back his mortgage, and he's profiting the difference. So the government-sponsored mortgage was designed to take what should have been, under normal circumstances without that, a 3-9-3 mortgage, meaning the bank lends it, the bank borrows at 3 to lend at 9 because of their time risk, and they'll be on the golf course at 3, right? To get it back to the classic 3-6-3, borrow at 3, lend at 6, be on the golf course at 3. That 3% got split up and socialized across the GSEs, the pension systems, the insurance companies, and, you know, and still the savers, right? The people that they're paying 3% to, the underlying 3% to, meaning the depositors in their bank, because they're paying the depositors 3%, so why they're borrowing at 3. They're lending at 6 on the golf course at 3, or whatever that is. If it's 2-5 or whatever it is, it doesn't matter. The important thing here is to understand that under normal circumstances, to get that 30-year note, it would have to, the bank would have to take on more than taking on more than 3% risk. But if that profit gets sliced and diced and socialized across the entire economy, where everybody's incentivized and everybody gets 50 basis points or 75 basis points for their troubles over and above what they would normally get, well, guess what? Everybody wins, right? And now you're building a system. Now you're building an economy from the ground up that is the envy of the world. Well, clearly, if you're, you know, the evil fucking British Empire, the last thing you want is for the American middle class to do this, because your goal is to reconquer your colonies by destroying the middle class and then setting forth that process of radicalizing the younger generations into either, again, the unquenchable envy of Marxism or the nihilism of the hyper individual libertarian, both of which are anti-civilizational, both of which fundamentally weaken the middle class, weaken the country, and weaken the spirit to rebuild the middle class, right? Everybody just checks out and says the system doesn't work for me. And then the system collapses from within. So why is Fannie and Freddie important? Because right now we have onerous and terrible 30-year mortgage requirements. There ain't no way that a kid in their late 20s, early 30s, a man and a woman making like, you know, 35, 40 grand a piece, think about this. This is really important. You had millennials who entered the job market in the low 20s, right? They've worked their way up. They're now making it in the low 40s. My daughter just started. Like, minimum wage now is $30,000 a year. But those 30-year-olds, those 35-year-olds are still making 40, 45, right? They can't make enough money to get out of their parents' basement. Okay? They can't do it. Like, unless they scrimp and save every dollar they have until they can come up with, in their mid-30s, enough money for 20% down on a mortgage. Because they don't have land that they can offset with and have any equity. And they're going to have to literally put $70,000 on the table or $40,000 on the table to buy a $300,000 house, whatever the math is. I'm just throwing numbers out there. You know what I mean? 20% down on a $300,000 house, you got to come up with $60,000. It's a lot of money. And most people don't have $60,000 to sit in the freaking bank, right? So, and then you're going to take that capital and you're going to put it into this mortgage. Like, there goes your entire nest egg. And you got to hand it to the fucking bank in order to, you know, like, are you kidding? Like, the system is so designed to destroy the middle class that now, yeah, you can qualify for an FHA loan, blah, 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 and only pay, put 3.5% down, fine. But it's a lot, all of these things are a lot harder, and they're a lot harder to do. And if you're starting your own business and you own your own business, you're not on a W-2, it's nearly impossible to get through underwriting because of the stupid shit that Dodd-Frank put in place, that Elizabeth Warren, you know, locked on top of it, and the Federal Reserve locked on top of it with the CFPB and the Federal Reserve, like all this stuff. I have been running around for 2 months now, 2.5 months, trying to get a freaking simple cash out remortgage at 60% loan to value ratio against my house. Right? Can't do it. Every time I think I'm through underwriting, they come back with some other thing and some other thing and some other thing. They're just stringing me along. And they're doing it on purpose. And I think part of it, I think they're doing it on purpose. And the other thing is that they just keep saying, we'll have to cover our asses. And, you know, every day it's another thing. It's another thing. It's another thing. And I'm like, dudes, I should have been out of underwriting 2 months ago. But this, because I'm not on a W-2, right? I'm not an employee of somebody's business. I'm self-employed. And self-employment is very, very difficult, especially if you have any kind of tax avoidance strategy in the United States that everybody does in order to, you know, stop paying ridiculous amounts of taxes, like basic everyday, you know, LLC structures in order to, you know, avoid paying $40,000 or $50,000 a year in income taxes. Like, seriously, if you've never done self-employment tax, which I have, and you're like, you realize just how unbelievable it is. But if I had been doing that, well, I would have gotten this mortgage ages ago. But because I choose not to pay friggin' $18,000 a year into Obamacare, I have to be given the runaround. This is what everybody deals with on a day-to-day basis. Since I started talking about this issue, I've had dozens, if not 100 friggin' people come out to me and say, be it from bankers or underwriters or friends or family or anybody else, are like, yeah, it's insane. It's so fucked. It's off the charts how fucked it is. So that has to end. Mm-hmm. The Fannie and Freddie IPO, the FHFA, needs to be destroyed. It was created to put Fannie and Freddie into conservatorship. Their rules are retarded. And I know what the plan is, because I've talked to people in the administration. They're going to IPO the damn thing. They're going to wind down the FHFA. Bill Pulte is going to go back to the private sector, and they're going to move it over to HUD or some other organization. And they're going to take the government's stake in the company to get the sovereign wealth fund and then use it to pay for Obamacare or Medicaid or whatever. That's what they're going to do there. But they have to declare an emergency in housing, get rid of Dodd-Frank rules by declaring an emergency and suspending Dodd-Frank, and then turn around to be able to lend to people at a reasonable rate so we can start rebuilding capital within the middle class. Because we've had weight, because this is the interesting thing. This is something, and I need to finish this point before we go on. I've had a lot of conversations with people about, you know, oh my God, housing is screwed in this country, and we're blah, 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 and the inflation of this, and like, everybody's doomer boomering, including like my friends Dave Collum, my friend Dave Collum, who I've literally argued in public about this with a half dozen times. So I'm not throwing Dave under the bus here. He and I have had these public debates on this, you know, public, very public debates on this. And, you know, it's, and so I think it's fair to invoke this here. But Dave's analysis about, you know, the valuation of the S&P 500 and housing, they're not wrong. But I kind of looked at it on the other side of it. I go back to what I said earlier. I said, you know, basically minimum wage or entry-level jobs in this country are $16, $17 an hour. That's roughly $30,000, $32,000 a year. Now, if you're looking at it, if you're looking at a young couple, 20, 22 years old, 22, 23 years old, you figure they get moved up to around 35 grand a year. Income times three. They both make 35 grand a year. And you go in to get a loan. That means they can afford, they make 70 grand. That means the income times three, they can afford a $210,000 starter home, which is about the cost of a starter home in America. You know, 2-1 or, you know, 2-1.5, 1,200, 1,300 square feet. You should be able to find on a halfway, you know, a halfway decent lot in the on the outskirts of a city. You should be able to find that house for that price, $210,000. You know, you're not living in Brooklyn. Sorry, but you're also not living in Brooklyn making 35 grand a year either. You're living in, you know, you're living in, you know, outside of, you're living in a suburb of Orlando. I'm trying not to use like my hometown as an example, or you're a suburb of Jacksonville or Atlanta or whatever. And you're, you know, you, Ohio, you can, yeah, Ohio or Iowa or wherever. You're living outside of Des Moines, for Christ's sake. You should be able to easily find a house for 200 grand, right? And, you know, find some halfway decent entry-level work for that amount of money. That seems like a start. So we've already had a lot of the wage inflation necessary. The is for the kids. The problem is what I talked about earlier with the millennials who came into the workforce at $20,000 or $25,000, have worked their way up to $45,000. They can't afford the next step-up house, right? Income times two is 90. Now they can only afford 270. And the house they want to raise a family of five in or four in is 400 grand.
Yeah.
They're at their income times five, income times six. They're the ones who can't get started. And that's what we have to fix. So, and I think we fix it in a variety. I think there's a number of different ways that we fix it. I don't want to go into all of them now because it's not necessary, but just understand this is the parameter of the problem. They're very smart people working on this stuff. But I think that, you know, ultimately, if we can get the wage inflation up the middle class, up in the, and this is part of the reason why the boomers not leaving the CEO ships, the boomers not leaving government and staying in the workforce until 70 fucking five, and not because they don't want to give their companies over to Gen X because they've always hated their fucking children, is so, what is such a problem, because they won't allow us to change the direction of these of the companies by moving into upper management and then allow the millennials to move in the middle, truly into, you know, upper management and CEO ships and board positions, get the millennials up in the upper management where they can make $75,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year, right? So there's this whole process, and the fucking boomers just refuse to leave the goddamn scene. And half of the reason is because they spent all their freaking money and they got $48,000 in their fucking 401ks and all of their wealth is in their home. So we either have to mobilize the equity in their home or get them to move. But they want more money for their house than anybody can afford to buy from them. So the best thing to do is honestly is to monetize the equity in their homes. And this is why I keep going back to this idea of, you know, that I floated about 6 months ago. And I think it's still floating around the administration that they have to do a reverse ELOC against people's equity and just pay them for the equity in their homes and then generate money off of that. You know, put that money and credit that money to the Treasury. The Treasury either pays debt with it or, you know, but put that money into circulation so that the boomers will, you know, feel comfortable enough to truly properly retire and get them out of the way. And then we can start the process of leveling everybody up through the housing system. And that's why Fannie and Freddie have to be IPO'd ultimately, because this is the fund. And this is the way you fix both the radicalization of the society and stave off the Civil War and, you know, restart entrepreneurship and at a fundamental level. So I think from an investor standpoint, everybody really needs to start thinking about, well, how can we get this? What loan products can we start to develop? What can we do? Right now, we're trapped with these ridiculous fucking rules that were put together by, you know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and the fucking city of London and Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank needs to be repealed, but we're not going to get it through this Congress, right? Until the midterms. So all that can happen now is reductions in force through shutdowns, right? Budget reconciliation, you know, declaration of emergencies, all this, anything that doesn't require Congress can get done, where the executive branch can operate around a recalcitrant Congress is what's getting done. And if you look very carefully, they're, all of that stuff's getting done. And Fannie and Freddie can come out of a conservatorship and be IPO'd. All they need is a sign off from the Treasury Secretary. You know, they're still negotiate. I think they're still in the negotiation phase over the details of how that gets dealt with. And there's a lot of verbiage out there as to how to deal with that that process. The senior preferred chairs, the junior preferred chairs, how much dilution, what, you know, all that stuff. But they, but the end of the day, like, it's not that hard. As long as you have an FHFA director like Pulte and a Treasury Secretary like Bessent and a president like Trump, they're all aligned to do what's right by the existing shareholders in Fannie and Freddie. We haven't had that.
Yeah.
Since 2008, we've had people who have been against that at some level or another, which is why it didn't get done during Trump's first term. So
Tom, a lot of this to me comes down to the price of money. Right? Mm-hmm. What interest rates are and how that is able to, let's say, stand in the way or stimulate the economy. You know, there's mm-hmm. been a lot of issues, let's say public issues between Trump and Powell.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, you can give me your thoughts on if that's kayfabe or not, but
it is.
You know, when we think about the path forward for the country, and Trump, you know, constantly banging the drum that he wants lower rates. Do lower right. rates actually solve the problems?
Well, this is the thing. It depends on what this is the problem that everybody's having to deal with. And again, I don't have a good answer. I don't have a definitive answer on this yet because I kind of feel like Jerome Powell. Trump is changing the way we're funding the government. We're changing the way we do business in America. We're changing the direction of capital flow. As opposed to sending money out and getting cheap consumer goods back, we now want the money to stay here and rebuild, right? That changes the risk profile of the United States. So that means we also have to fix the budget. We also have to fix this. We also have to fix that. So the question of the price of money under the pure Keynesian model of Triffin's paradox of being the world's reserve currency and everything else, that scenario, right, is the rubric that everybody's talking about interest rates within, right? Because that's what we've been trained to talk about, because that was the system we all grew up in. But that system's going away. Trump is clearly challenging all of that. Bessent is challenging all of that. The Federal Reserve is going to be reformed. I think that Jerome Powell is, you know, setting the table for it to be reformed. And I think that goes all the way back to the first time you and I ever spoke about, you know, my initial thoughts about the implementation of SOFR and how that interfaced with LIBOR and why SOFR was eventually going to win and all of that stuff. And if you don't know what those two things are, secured overnight financing rate is the dead end indexing rate of the dollar now around the world, as opposed to the London Interbank Offered Rate. So no longer City of London is in control of the price of dollars globally. Now the American repo market, the American demand for dollars is, and that's being translated out to the rest of the world. Through a Federal Reserve and through a Treasury and through a tariff wall that can raise or lower the cost of international dollars, regardless of what the Fed's Fed funds rate is. Trump can alter the tariff structure so that we can have 2% interest rates here, but the cost of capital for dollars is effectively 5% overseas. We have he has set up the ability to do that, to have, you know, one price, par price for the dollar domestically and a different par price for the dollar internationally. And structurally speaking, I think that's where the reform of the Federal Reserve goes. And I don't have, like, you know, a huge, like, treatise on this. And these are the laws that have to be rewritten. And these are the Fed rules that have to be rewritten. Just in general, if you think about it, the Fed's job is to backstop the commercial paper market in the United States and provide the lowest cost of capital that we can get away with in the U.S. while preserving the international par value of the dollar and helping Trump create help create that tariff wall, right? And help create those two different things so that if we incentivize people to come and invest here, they can invest here at a cost of capital, say 2%, but as opposed to buying dollars from us and then invest those dollars overseas having paid 5% for them or 4% for them or whatever it is. And it's that differential. And eventually that differential should go to close to zero and say be 25 basis points. But right now it's going to be high because the imbalance is so high. So as these things happen, so this is part of the problem with trying to analyze or think about these systems, because what the cost of capital should be, is because the system is changing, and right. None of us have any experience dealing with, you know, the implications of that system. And this is exactly what Jerome Powell has said all year long before he finally cut rates. He said, I don't know what the effects of tariffs are going to be. I know what the inflation impulses are now. So but it's not like he doesn't understand what Bessent and Trump are trying to do. Clearly, he was using all of that as an excuse to keep the cost of capital high for the entire world, to give Trump extra leverage to cut trade deals, the trade deals that he has cut, which are all unbelievably in the U.S.'s favor. And Bessent pursued a weak dollar policy, which pushed everybody's currencies up versus the dollar. And then Powell kept the cost of dollars high. And, you know, effectively, they got to borrow dollars against stronger currencies and, you know, just gutting the import, the export markets of all these countries trying to import into the United States. So, you know, with a higher, so, you know, they're earning fewer euros at home, because the dollar is so freaking weak. Oh, and by the way, you also have to pay more money, and you're getting a higher cost of capital, you know, to borrow dollars that you need. Like, it's all just hilarious. So, weak dollar plus high interest rates equals gut foreign importers or exporters. And that's it's basically a Texas hedge or double long on that particular, front. But once Trump got all of his wins on the board, kind of solved Israel, Iran for the most part, got the EU to agree to a ridiculous trade deal, you know, got the one big beautiful bill passed, all of this stuff. Then Powell's like, hey, you know what we can do? We can get rid of the 2% inflation target, this is Powell speaking, which I was never in favor of in the first place, which Bernanke put in place unilaterally back in 2007. So we're getting rid of that, and we're going to focus on the dual mandate. But specifically, we're going to focus on the labor portion of the economy, which is now aligning Federal Reserve policy with Trump's domestic and fiscal policy. This is what's happening. Like, I can't make it any more explicit than that. Now, is Jay going to go slowly cutting rates, slower than Trump wants? Probably. But, you know, I look at, I've said this before in other podcasts, and I'll reiterate it here. Everybody talks about, you know, all the MAGAtards like to talk about Donald Trump as being like Orange Jesus, right? That he's come back from, you know, he's the billionaire that doesn't need this. He could live a great life on his own, but he's coming here to run the country to save it, blah, 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 blah. Well, one could make that same argument about Scott Bessent. Does Scott Bessent need to be freaking Treasury Secretary? He's a freaking billionaire. He doesn't need to do this. Same thing with Jerome Powell. I mean, Daniel DiMartino Booth, friend of ours, but both of you, you've had Daniel on your show about half a dozen, for all show, half a dozen times. Daniel used to make this point all the time. Why does Jay Powell want a second term? Why did he want it so bad? Like, why would he go through this? He could have, like, walked off into the sunset, let Lael Brainard take over, go back to private equity and make billions of dollars because she was going to fuck everything up. And Powell knew exactly what she was going to do. No, he chose to go through all of that pain, to take all of that opprobrium, to shepherd SOFR all the way through to the end, until it's now the law of the land, and raise interest rates and shepherd through trying to deal with the mistakes. And the best people can come up with is that Jerome's worried about his legacy. That's a bullshit argument. It has nothing to do with that. Powell doesn't care. He's doing what's right. It's like Trump is doing what's right and what's right. And those three guys are all larger than life figures, immensely successful men and immensely egotistical men. So are they going to clash a little bit? Of course they are. Is that healthy? Yes. That's my perspective. You can salt that to taste. You can write that down. You can take out a 0% loan against that. I don't give a shit. Buy yourself a clue. There it is. That's what I think.
But Tom, when we think about, you know, this 2% inflation target, and if if Powell has truly, let's just call it, abandoned that target, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What does that actually mean? You know, if we end up having and holding a higher inflation rate than 2%, doesn't that also really, you know, stand against, like, exactly opposed to rebuilding the middle class? Because if you're
I don't think that the 2% inflation target, I think the 2% inflation target was designed to ensure that the middle class was gutted. I don't think Powell abandoning the 2% inflation target is saying we're going to have 3% inflation, or we're going to accept 4% inflation. I don't think that at all. I think Powell knows that inflation is whipped, and he's got so many of these deflationary forces that are happening, both demographically and AI and this and that and everything else. Like, I don't think any of that's going to be quote unquote inflationary long term. If you look at where the bulk of inflation comes from, right? Well, directionally, it's been tied for the last couple of years to the price of gasoline, directionally, month to month to month, and over, we may be at a point now where that's finally beginning to end. We'll see. And that, to me, was commodity cost push inflation. But the overall magnitude of the inflation year over year and whatnot was all driven by things like housing and healthcare. And, you know, now it's going to be electricity is the big buzzword for the day. But it's all these things that insurance costs, all of these things that were all financially driven by way too much money floating around the system. All of those things are completely threatened by deregulation, ending Medicare fraud, Medicaid fraud, like going through Social Security fraud, all of this stuff. And so if you not just balance the budget, I'm going to be honest with you, Tom. I know that Russ Vogt has at least $1.3 trillion worth of cuts that he is itching to implement in the next 60 days. Meaning,
because of the shutdown?
In the time it's going to, during the shutdown. And the shutdown has to last 61 days, as Peter St. Ange pointed out yesterday, because you got to give federal workers 60 days notice that you're firing. So on day 61, that's when the rug gets pulled. That's when everybody goes home. Now, think through that process. I know, like, firsthand knowledge. I know Rust, or okay, second or third hand knowledge. I know that they have $1.3 to $1.5 trillion that they could easily cut right out of the budget tomorrow. That they, if they could snap their fingers, they would, but they can't because of Congress. But the shutdown has given them the opportunity now to do so through reduction of force and all the rest of it. And he's going to do it. And he's not lying. He's like, he's there. And I've been warning everybody that Russ Vogt at OMB was the guy that everybody should be paying attention to. And nobody listened to me. Well, at least nobody powerful listened to me. That's why. But they did. You know what I mean? Like, I kept saying it over and over and over again. They went, nah, Luongo's just LARPing and fanficking again. I'm like, really? And now all of a sudden, Russ Vogt is the most powerful man in the government. I wonder why. So they can balance it. They do that. They can balance the budget. Right. Because between the cuts that have already gone through and the other things that are happening, like, you know, the Biden deficit is gone. Now, do you think there's not another $1 trillion worth of waste within DOD, the intelligence services, this, that, everything else? I think so easily. I think we can find at least another $1 trillion, which means that what happens when we find that out? And we can give everybody a tax break. Or And we have these other deflationary things that are happening. This is all deflationary. I mean, you're pushing a lot. You're not spending $1.7 trillion in deficit into the economy, raising prices every year. That's gone. Like, you're not going to be dealing with the 2% or 3% inflation rate. You're going to be dealing with a 0% inflation rate, because all of the things that I'm talking about now are going to start seeing massive deflation in things like insurance costs, healthcare costs, housing costs. And I don't mean just, like, I don't think housing prices are going to drop significantly. They may drop in certain markets. There's going to be rotation. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the cost of maintaining a home, the actual true cost of maintaining a home, especially if they bring interest rates down. All of that stuff is going to push a lot more money through the economy, the productive portion of the economy, and not through the financial portion of the economy. And it's going to rebalance how that plays out. And then, you know, with the amount of money that Trump has got to invest from all these trade deals, we're going to see a huge boom in, you know, infrastructure spending of variety of sources. Mining is going to, you know, mining and new roads and fixing. I mean, we have infrastructure work that needs hundreds of billions of dollars, not trillions of dollars worth of, you know, bridge repair, road repair, everything else in order to get this stuff done. So there's so much to do. And I think just that's not going to be inflationary. That's going to stave off deflation. So
how far down the road do you think that those deflationary forces actually start to come into play here, Tom? Because that seems like a longer road for
those. I mean, I think they're already here. I mean, trueflation has been running less than 2% for most of the year, on a daily basis. I haven't looked at it recently. Let's see where it is right now as we're sitting here doing this. If I can actually get to the actual data and they not try to sell me their stupid system. Their front page has gotten really annoying. The trueflation rate right now is 2.25%. And okay, that's fine. And it's not, and it's been flat for months on end now. I mean, it's been variable. It's been as low as, I mean, in April it was 1.2%. So I don't know. I mean, I look at it and I say, you know, it's not, you know, it's not a dire scenario, because I think we're going to have wage growth greater than 2% going forward. Because, you know, there's going to be, look at GDP growth was what revised up for Q2 up to 3.8%. We haven't even gotten started yet. And I'm not a huge fan of GDP. I mean, I got to throw the numbers out there that we have, right? Like the CPI is, you know, is a bullshit number. The jobs number is a bullshit number. The GDP is gross national spending, yada, yada, yada. There's all these things. I'll be happy with GDP like being flat as long as we're spending more money on the productive portion of the economy rather than the waste and fraud portion of the economy, which is what we've been doing. And because that waste and fraud is being used to destroy, to create chaos within the country that is actually retarding the productive capacity of the country. So, you know, that money is going to pay for Antifa riots. That money is going to pay for cops that don't arrest anybody. It's going for judges that don't, you know, don't put criminals in jail. It's for all of these things. It's going for H-1B visa holders that are sitting in Mumbai making 65 grand a year and leaving, you know, an American on the side of the road scrambling. And, you know, I'm like, it's all of this stuff. And that all just needs to change, like every bit of it. And so I've been saying for so long now, I'm like, you mean to tell me that we spend $7 trillion a year and we can't find, you know, we can't find $2 trillion in waste? Really? We spent that much money in 2019. Why is 2025 so goddamn special? Like, it's not hard. It's a matter of, well, they can't do it because, and I hear the same stuff out of all these people on a regular basis. Well, they can't do it because of Congress. Like, really? Have you listened to what the American people are saying? Really? Have you watched how Donald Trump has outmaneuvered Congress over and over and over and over again? And like, you're just not listening. You're like everybody. What really frustrates me, and I don't mean to be mean about this or rude or anything else. I'm like, I really wish that the commentary, general commentary in the space was just higher level. I want people to stop using the same arguments they made 15 years ago. We're in a different regime today. And we all should be like really talking about what we think is going on, as opposed to just running the scripts in our heads and, you know, based on, you know, whatever we used to be taught, whatever we think we know. Like, here's one for you, Tom. You know, if you ask an average, if you have asked, I don't care if it's Grok or ChatGPT or this one or that one, they'll all say the same thing. Most of them don't think that the boomers have started retiring yet or dying off. Meanwhile, and we keep talking about like the whole boomer problem and unfunded liabilities and all the rest of it, as if the boomers haven't died off yet, and yet 25% of them are in the ground. We're at least, we're nearing the top of the boomer die-off rate and the maximum carnage it's going to cause fiscally in the United States. We're within 1 or 2 years, we're within 2 or 3 years of the peak of this, and then we're going to be on the downside of it. And you don't think that's going to have like profound effects on things like housing? And it's the biggest generation ever. And then they're all, and the nursing homes and the healthcare costs and everything else. Like, but I hear these arguments on a regular basis that literally come like, it's like I'm listening to the same crap I listened to when I got radicalized by this stuff back in the early aughts, like back there, you know, toward 2010, 2011, 2013. I'm like, they're all still making arguments like Jim Rickards just published The Death of Money. And no, we're in it now. It's happening. It's right here. And we're in it. And we're not. And so many people are just thinking, I just can't, I can't take it anymore. And so, you know, when, because I don't want to feel like I'm the only guy thinking like this. You know what I mean? And I don't, I know that I'm not, but I don't want to feel that way anymore. I want to feel like I can have collegiate conversations with people on Twitter that actually take all these things into account. And that's not what's happening. Mm-hmm. What's happening is a lot of people are crashing out, holding on to old arguments that aren't valid anymore, and are either doing so because their business model demands that they do so, and that's their audience, or because they really aren't nearly as sharp as they always were, and they were riding a wave that, you know, I wish it wasn't that way. I really wish it wasn't that way. I'm not saying that I'm so wise and insouciant and ahead of the game that I thought through every one of the potential problems that are out there. No, that's what I mean. I know I'm only looking at a small portion of this. That, you know, as much as I try to look at everything, I know that I'm still only maybe seeing 30% of the picture, 35% of the picture. So why can't we actually talk about all the big stuff? Like, if I hear one more person tell me that Japan is going to implode, I'm going to scream. I'm like, Kyle Bass has been making this fucking argument for 20 years. And then he turns into Peter Zeihan. Then he turns into this one. Then he turns into that one. Japan is not going to implode. Japan has beaten these guys over and over and over.
My mind went with that is, you know, there's so many of these different situations that we have to look at, that we have to have an opinion on, that, you know, to understand it deeply is kind of a challenge. But to be able to, you know, talk through it and figure it out, I think it, to your point, is where the value comes from. But explain to me, you know, what you said Jim Rickards was talking about the death of money, right? Is that this idea that because of, let's say, the boomers dying off, and that let's just call it the velocity of that money slowing down, is that what it, kind of the framework that he's talking about?
I invoked Jim's the death of money, it's only because I remind myself, like, not necessarily the arguments he was making back then, but that's like the book that, you know, put him on the map, or there's a number of books that he wrote that I'm like those arguments from back then were the arguments that were being made, that the United States can't support this, that we're moving into this era of QE and this and that. And I'm not saying Jim was wrong. Clearly, we're going to see a much higher gold price. We're going to have to see a much higher silver price. We're at a moment now in time where the world is breaking, where globalism is breaking down, where we're moving towards a, you know, as Vince Lanchi would like to put it, and every time Vince uses the word mercantilism, he gets to throw a dollar in the swear jar. Like I get to throw a dollar in the swear jar. Vince gets to throw a dollar in the mercantilism jar.
He actually didn't use it on our podcast 2 days ago.
Nice. I love it. I had dinner and a cigar with Chris Marcus the other night, and that was Chris's joke. It was just hilarious, right? It was fun. So, but I love Vince to death. He's one of these guys that just constantly challenging the narrative and constantly pushing not just myself, but everybody else. I adore Vince for this reason. He's like one of my favorite, very favorite people in the world to discuss these things with, because he's so open to new ideas, and that's what I'm looking for. And but what I meant by the, you know, I think that what Rickards was talking about back then, if I remember correctly, and forgive me if I get this wrong, and forgive me, Jim, if I get any of your arguments wrong, because I'm now pulling stuff out of the gray matter from 15 years ago, is that, you know, we are entering a phase of money printing to support asset valuations that, you know, can't be sustained. And so then we went through the entire massive inflation of the zero bound era, where the Fed wasn't even a central bank anymore. It was just another freaking euro dollar producer. That's what the Fed is, the zero bound. It has no ability to control the cost of capital. But we've clearly changed that dynamic. Like, that dynamic is no longer holding true. And then the bigger question is if we're analyzing the world from that perspective back then, today, that's the wrong framework. That was a LIBOR system. That was a coordinated global central bank policy. That was clearly the preparatory work for moving individual central banks towards a global central bank with a global central authority, as Jim was talking about back then, with the UN would be the would be the global government, and monetary policy would be set by the IMF and the BIS, and everybody else, you know, and sovereign nations will go away, and because money was going to die, and that the only people who could actually actually pay for all that would be when the central banks go broke for the central banks of the world. Right. And that was clearly the plan. And I didn't argue with Jim back then at all. I thought he was right. Right. And I still think that, but anybody who's still arguing from that perspective is out of his mind. Like, cause they're just not looking at what's happening. What's happening is that the world is breaking up into currency blocks. It's what's happening is the world is buying gold like you would not believe. And now, and to Jim's credit, he's now saying exactly the same thing. Gold is now, you know, becoming a thing. I don't think gold and silver ever become, I don't think silver ever becomes a monetary asset. So right. Would this, I read some stuff, you know, some comments from Jim recently, and I'm like, I don't buy the silver angle on it at all. I think silver is an industrial metal. And until the day comes when the, when central banks start putting it on their balance sheets, fine, but they're not. And until that point, the gold to silver ratio is still continuing to go up through time as silver loses monetary character because of it's such a good metal industrially for so many things that are important for high tech and for the future economy that we're building, that there's no, that Mises' regression theorem says silver is never going to retain its regain its monetary character. It's going to be replaced by Bitcoin, and it is being replaced by Bitcoin. So what's happening? It's a gold and Bitcoin bimetallic standard now, not a gold and silver bimetallic standard. That's my view. But clearly, we're moving towards where we need pristine collateral. That's the ultimate argument. And yeah, I don't think anybody in the space would argue that gold is not going much, much higher, right? I mean, even Martin Armstrong, I think the last time I spoke with Marty personally, and I watched a couple of videos of his, or at least some excerpts, and now Marty's talking about $10,000 to $12,000 gold. When for years, decades, Martin was only talking $5,000 to $7,000. Five to seven K. And he even admitted it recently in one of his private blog posts. Like, I never thought I'd be talking about five figure gold. And I always looked at it, you know, and again, I'm not like tooting my own horn here or anything. I'm like, I think 5 to 7,000 is a little low given the amount of leverage and the amount that the central banks are leveraged. I just don't think that when we get out of this period of history, that the central banks are all going to have to be levered based on their gold and pristine collateral reserves of about 2 to 3 to 1. 2 or 3 to 1, not 5 or 6 to 1 or 7 to 1. I don't think they're going to be, I think in order to for the system to regain the trust of the people, the national governments and banks and central banks, if the central banks even survive, are going to have to be leveraged no more than 2 to 1, 3 to 1. And that means that, you know, with a $6.2 trillion balance sheet, that means that, you know, American gold reserves have to, you know, have to more than double from here. So we're at 3,800. So we're looking at, you know, easily looking at, you know, 10 grand. So 10, 12, I think Marty's right. I think 10 to 12 grand is the number we should be looking at. Because I also think the Fed's going to have to expand their balance sheet back to $7 or $7.5 trillion. Like, I don't think that that is going to be, I think that's going to happen as well. It's going to be a mix of those two things. It's going to be a mix of QE plus some gold, this, and everything's going to get rebalanced higher in order to be able to support asset prices from collapsing, so that we don't have societal collapse. Because otherwise, we have societal collapse, then Marxism, then blood in the streets, then dogs and cats living together. And, you know, I don't give a shit about my gold or my silver. I only care about how many canned sardines I've got in storage, how much toilet paper I've got, and how much ammunition I've got. Everything else does not fucking matter.
Yeah. So, well, Tom, when we think about that gold revaluation, and there's certain people that talk about it like it's QE, what are the mechanics of that? And like, does the US actually have to go through selling some of that gold in order to quote unquote monetize it?
I think the whole QE argument thing is so fucking overplayed. It's unbelievable. I think Zero Hedge has done a very bad job of teaching people what is and is not QE. And I've lost all patience for it. QE is a very specific thing. Okay. It's a very specific thing. It's buying government debt to monetize it, put it on the Fed's balance sheet. That's what QE is. Okay. Yeah. And Operation Twist is just changing the term structure of it. Fine. Gold going up in price is not QE. Now, I know what people are thinking about in terms of like the revaluation of gold. Like, we revalue it from $11 billion, our current world gold reserves, from $11 billion, and we market to $1 trillion, and we put that money in the Treasury's account. That's not QE. If the Treasury turns around and, because it's not, because what are we doing? Yes, the Fed's balance sheet goes up by $1 trillion. And okay, it looks like QE, but it's not QE because we didn't act. All we did was we marked an asset we actually have to market. It's a physical asset with a marketable value. The Fed could sell that 8,110 tons of gold tomorrow and actually get $1 trillion for it. Sorry, that's not QE. QE is taking a debt instrument, issuing new currency with it, and putting it on the Fed's balance sheet and levering it up through the banking system. This is not QE, folks. That's a fundamentally different thing. It's like everybody who complained that the bank term funding program after Silicon Valley Bank was QE. It was like, no, it's exactly the opposite of QE. It's just a collateralized loan above Fed funds rate, for Christ's sake. That's not QE. Danielle complained about this. I complained about it. So many other, and then we had just all this nonsense out there. Everybody wants to. This is what I mean by the level of the commentary. It's just not that good from people who know better. Like, and I that's not QE. It's something. I'm not saying it's not going to be inflationary or this or that or anything else. Fine, but it's not QE. It's very important that we use our terms properly, and we don't just mix. We don't just play commie word games and label everything we don't like QE. Like everything commies do, everything they don't like, they label capitalism or racism or sexism or misogynism or misogyny or whatever. Like, it's the same thing. This is exactly what the fucking hard money crowd does. Everything they don't like is QE. Like, no, you want the United States to, because here's the thing. When people make that argument, then you have to ask, what's their motivation for that? And I'll tell you exactly what their motivation is. It's exactly the thing I complained about earlier in the podcast. They want to be right, and they want the United States to fail because they hate their fucking country. And because they hate their country, they will go out of their freaking way to make bad fucking arguments about what's actually going on. And that's what's actually happening. I can't tell you and make it any more explicit. Peter Schiff hates the United States for what they did to his dad. And that's what animates everything he does. Everything. And fair cop, to be honest with you, doesn't make him a good man. It doesn't make him a good analyst. Like, it's all bullshit. Like, at the end of the day, it's all nonsense. Like, the words that come out of his mouth are incorrect. In the big macro picture, yeah, he's got some things that are right. But when it comes to, like, this kind of thing, are you kidding me? Seriously? Like, who's listening to him anymore? Like, the only reason they let him on CNBC is because he's a joke. And they like making fun of making fun of the hard money guy. And it gives the rest of us a bad name. That's why they let him on. I'm at that point with all of this stuff, and I can't take it anymore because we have a country and a world and a civilization to save, not anybody's ego to salve about being right. When I was first hired by Newsmax, I was in the interview process with basically the assistant publisher and the woman who eventually became my editor. Apparently, I was doing really well, and then she finally asked me the most important question of the entire interview. So what's more important? Being right or being honest? And I said, being honest. Because if it's more important for you to be right, then you're going to fight for when you're going to fight for that decision you made to put that particular stock in the portfolio that you were wrong about. And as opposed to admitting the fact that you were wrong and that you're honest about it and you just tell your subscribers, nope, we made a mistake and we're moving on.
Yeah.
Okay. This is what I'm getting at. There are way too many people who have been trained. We train our financial analysts the same way we train our politicians. Never show weakness. I was taught that by Newsmax. Like, the way to write a financial newsletter is to be like Donald Trump. Yep, that was a mistake. Moving on. Or is this everything's either a buy or a sell? There's no, well, I'm going to hold on to it, but you should probably lighten your position. That's anathema to the newsletter writing industry. Why? Because I'm supposed to be the guru. I'm not a guru. I'm just a dude trying to, give you some good ideas and some good trading strategies. And I want to teach you how to manage your portfolio, not just tell you what stocks to buy. Like, that's a different, and that, by the way, is the level up. And it's the same thing. We teach our financial analysts the same way. Like, no, go out there and be a leader and be strong and have a definitive opinion and blah, 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 blah. Okay, fine. But what happens when you're wrong? What happens when your thesis is incorrect? As opposed to having and I thought long and hard about this, and this is the way I am, which is to say, look, I'm going to put this thing out there. I want you to think about it. I think I'm right about it, and I'm going to act as if I'm right about it. But if I'm wrong, if I come back to be wrong later, I'm going to say, dude, I was wrong about that.
Yeah.
But this is why I was wrong. And now you know why I was wrong. And now I'm going to update the thesis and update the process, and we'll move on and we'll get better. And that's an iterative process. And I just find this, so much of what we have is just kind of programmatic. There's so much commentary is just programmatic at this point. It's not collegiate, it's programmatic. And I find that very, very distressing. The farther this goes along here, and then of course it's like everything else. Well, the people who, and it's again, same thing. Like in politics, you never attack down. If you're the front runner, you never attack down, because you have nothing to gain from attacking down, because all you're doing is giving free press to your opponent. So you never attack down. Anybody who attacks down isn't really winning. That means the polls are fake. They're actually losing. That's why they attack down. That's why Rudy Giuliani's career was over when he attacked Ron Paul in 2008 at the debate, right? He attacked down and then he looked weak. And it destroyed his political career because he attacked the guy polling 3% when he was the front runner. Mm. Classic mistake. Well, I got news for you. Same thing exists very, very, I can, again, old politics guy, I can see that playing out within the commentary space. I see it everywhere. I see it in the politics space. I see it in finance. I see it everywhere, which is that there are strata. And, you know, it, once somebody levels up into a particular strata, they never want to interface with the people in the lower strata than them. And I'm like, yeah, no, that's not the way I operate. Like I go on new podcasts all the time, because I find this is how we can find new voices. Not just, I mean, you're an exception here because you and I have a long, long relationship from your previous job. And so therefore I want to help you do this thing. And I would never say no to you, Tom. But I mean, I get calls to come on to like little podcasts all the time. And they're like, oh, would you really? I'm so happy. I'm like, dude, I'll do anybody's show once. Why? Because I might find some new brilliant voice in the space that is going to be able to, you know, help all of us do our job. I think that's really important for all of this. And I think it's a very important point that's how we segregate and how we prioritize who are the voices that we should, and I don't say who the voices we should listen to and who the voices we shouldn't listen to, but more appropriately, the standard that we want to hold all of our commentators that we value to.
Yeah.
And if a guy is like here and he doesn't want to go higher, well, push him higher, or, you know, or stop listening, or do whatever you need to do, vote with your feet, but push him higher. And my people push me every day, like hard. I know you're a member of the community. You can see it. You see it in the comments on the Patreon on everything. And it's like, I get pushed daily. Mm-hmm. And I want that. I crave that, because that's how I get better at this.
So exactly in that theme, Tom, what do you think will, just, I think just to simplify this, what do you think makes, let's say, a pass or a fail for Donald Trump's presidency here? You know, he ran on this platform.
Ooh, that's really good question.
He ran on this platform of peace. He ran on the platform of closing the borders. He ran on the platform of cutting deficits, you know, all of these different things, government reform. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've made some progress in some of these. And again, I think, you know, to give some credit where credit is due, I think a lot of these things are a complicated, long process that has to play out over a couple of years. Granted, what we see in the first, I don't know, let's call it 200 days, something like that, just over 200 days of his presidency, a lot of the conflicts around the world have not been solved. If anything, there has been some escalation or seemingly some escalation. Exactly. Like there's just so much of this that I think takes time on one hand, but at the end of the day, or at the end of a presidency, what do you think marks a pass or fail on his part?
I'm glad you took the time to like set that up so I can really think, because I was thinking about it the entire time, because I was not expecting that comment, that question at all. So that was good. I appreciate this. This is a good question. And I think the first thing that popped into my head, and as I said earlier, I tend to like to go with my first instinct. is the following. It's very simple. Does Trump get a durable mandate at the midterms? Does he get a major pass by the voters in America? Meaning, does he get that 50 to 70 seat majority in the House that he earned in 2024, but they stole from him? I mean, they stole at least 35 House seats from him. They stole at least 5 Senate seats through vote harvesting after the fact. When it was clear on election night that they couldn't manufacture enough votes to take the presidency away from him, they immediately shifted. I could see it like happening because I was watching it all happen. You could see it happening that they were now targeting they stopped vote counting in like 35 to 40 House seats. They stopped counting on like 5 Senate seats. So what's really important for Trump is not all of these things that you and I've talked about, like Fannie and Freddie, which is going to happen, or any of this other stuff. What's going to be important here is that he's maintained the trust of the American people to give him the durable majority he needs, the real majority he needs in both the House and the Senate to complete the job in the last 2 years of his presidency and hand it off to either Marco Rubio or J.D. Vance or whomever in 2028. I know he likes to troll everybody with Trump 2028, but I don't think he's running again. He's not. He's going to be 82 years old. He already looks tired. Like, you know, job well done. He's done. So that's what I would. And that's what I would consider a pass. And because it would imply two things. One, that he actually made the case with the American people. That's one. And two, he cleaned up the voter rolls enough to stop to get a closer picture of what the country actually is, as opposed to the fake version of the country that the election results and the media like to present to us. Me personally, I think this country is something like 57-43, if not 60-40, quote unquote, red. You know, that's what I think. Now, I also think the definition of red and blue have moved so far to the left that it doesn't really matter because Donald Trump is a centrist Democrat, not, you know, a hardcore fiscal conservative, you know, a hardcore Republican. I think he's the second coming of JFK, right? But he's running against open friggin' communists. So these are our choices. But that's a significant, there's still significant difference between these two groups of people. And I think when you look at it from that perspective, that's what London, City of Davos, City of London, Davos, you know, Evil Corp Central, whatever you want to call them. That's what they fear more than anything else, that we actually get truth about anything. Mm-hmm. And so if Trump has revised the systems on which government operates and which our elections operate, and we get something closer to a real election in places like Arizona and Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota and Nevada and, you know, so many of these places, Pennsylvania, that he's made the case with the average person, not the person out on the lunatic fringe of financial and political commentary, which is what I do. Right? It's a very specific thing for a very sophisticated audience, right? And it's not for general consumption. The general consumption for average people is he doing the right thing by them? And if so, which I think he has done yeoman's work on that, I think he's turned losing issues into 80-20, what he likes to call 80-20 issues. And he's executed on those. And people see the what he's trying to do, and they see what he's up against. And I don't think he'll have any problem selling that in the midterms. The question is whether or not there's going to be some wrinkle on the vote fraud for next fall that will, you know, preclude him from being able to do that. But if he does win a significant majority, it will prove those two things. One, he communicated effectively with the American people. And two, we cleaned up the system to the point where we got something close to the actual truth of what our elections are. And you'll know if he is successful on both of those fronts if a bunch of governors try to secede from the union between now and July 4th, because their only move at that point is to try and go for the Civil War strategy. That's it. That's the only move left they have on the board. And he's maneuvered them into that move. Mm-hmm. And if I wouldn't even say it's Trump, personally, I think Stephen Miller is the guy doing all of this. I've been saying this from the beginning. Stephen Miller is the guy you should be watching like a hawk, because he's the one who's putting the Gantt chart together. We, you know, and between him and Trump and a couple other people, they know exactly what they're doing and how they're manipulating their opposition into bad moves, like the shutdown. The shutdown is a terrible move for them. And it signals to me that they are trying to go for setting up a Lincoln-esque moment for Trump. That's what I think is coming. Mm-hmm. So that's the answer to that question. I hope that was good enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely gives us something to consider.
Sure.
Especially, you know, again, reiterating the point that I think a lot of this stuff does take time to be able to not necessarily fix, but at least change meaningfully to you know, have a new direction, or at least a more appropriate direction for a lot of these different issues that we're facing in the world.
No, I agree. And again, this is, and it's hard for, you know, I've gotten to the point now where the guy wasn't in office 30 days and there were already people screaming that he wasn't moving fast enough. As far as I'm concerned, all those people to me are foreign operatives. I'm dead serious. Like that's the way I view them at this point. Like if you think that, you know, that 30 days into his presidency, he doesn't, you know, he hasn't arrested Hillary Clinton or this one or that one, like that's your litmus test for whether he's a failure or not. Like, I'm sorry, purity spiraling boy, you need to go fuck off to the hinterlands and get the fuck off Twitter and go touch grass and pet your fucking dog, because that's not the way this world works. Mm-hmm. And you know it, and you're being a child, and you're being a petulant child on top of everything else. So you're either being a petulant child because you are a petulant child, which means, yes, go out, touch grass, get the fuck off Twitter and go pet your dog, or you work for fucking City of London. Which is it, Thomas Massey? And I'm calling him out directly, because fuck that guy and fuck Rand Paul. They're both Democrats, as far as I'm concerned at this point. They're both side. Every time a big issue comes up, they should be on the side of, hey, they're both supposed to be libertarians. What's the first thing Rothbard always said? Never let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Oh, you forget all that. Conveniently, when it comes down to I have to fundraise for next year's primary. Yeah, go fuck yourselves, both of you. I'm done. Over, finished. They both. It's so clearly obvious at this point. And I'm not just talking about them. I'm talking about all these people. Like at this point, you have to ask yourself, you know, what's your goal structure? And again, I go back to the whole idea of critics versus architects. I go back to, you know, are you man enough to be an architect? You know, and that means getting your hands dirty while you try and build something. And Donald Trump knows, you know, a thing or two about getting his hands dirty to get something built, because he's kind of built some of the most impressive properties in the world. And if you don't think that he didn't have to grease a palm here or pay off a friggin' union boss there, like, what are you, 12? Seriously? Come on.
Tom, one of the other things, or the let's say the last things I wanted to cover here with you is this change of the way that U.S. debt is handled, not only handled, but let's say the places where we have the ability to put more debt. And of course, the stablecoin market is one of those big, you know, kind of question marks at this point. Mm-hmm. How big do you think that market can actually be? Like, is this going to become a meaningful buyer of U.S. debt?
Yeah, I think it's two things, right? Let's start with the first one. How much debt do we really need to buy if we balance the budget? We have to sell to balance when we balance the budget.
Yeah.
Now the debt that needs to be rolled over, and it can be rolled over and sold to different people, right? You know, the holders of that debt may decide to sell that debt to somebody else. So let's start with the beginning. Let's start with the basic one, which is that don't assume that we're going to be running a $1.7 trillion deficit going forward. The bigger question is, are we going to be creating money that, again, let's talk about the revaluation of gold, right? What if you revalue gold to, you know, $3,900 an ounce? You use it to retire, $500 billion worth of debt and, you know, sell the rest of it into the lending system, to issue local stable coins. But again, the Genius and Clarity bills are not finished yet, right? One has been passed, the other one hasn't. So until that whole framework is in place, you know, this is actually a premature argument. The question you should be asking is, can that be the question you ask implies this question, is a better way of putting it, which is, if what Trump is doing with taxes, Fannie and Freddie, re-empowering the middle class, if that's successful, where is that new demand for money going to show up? How is that money going to get instantiated? Is it going to come through the Federal Reserve system, or is it going to go through the U.S. Treasury system and the stablecoin system?
Yeah.
Which then bypasses the Fed, goes directly to the local banks, right? And then that money is spent locally into the economy, lent into the economy to build local businesses. The banks get the direct dividend benefit off of this, and the shareholders in the banks, because the reserves are now monetized directly into products, into businesses and development in the local economy. That money stays there, is then paid back as interest to savings holders, and the whole system is now, and the whole local banking system is now strengthened, and the demand for money locally continues to rise on its own, right? And if the banks are well managed and all of that is backed by hard and pristine collateral, meaning you seed that system, say, with the revaluation of gold. And now I'm just purely vamping, Tom. This is all just coming into my head as I answer this question to you, because I hadn't really thought about this. So let's think about it this way. You know, you want to add that money into the system, and this is treasury stable coins backed by pristine collateral, not US debt, you know, based on tax receipts, but actual, honest to God, pristine collateral. Ooh, that's a different animal. That's got a different cost structure to it. That's got a different risk, you know, weighting associated with it, blah, 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 blah. Now, all of a sudden, you're talking about lending against, you know, hard assets in a local economy. That's like going back to the 1840s. That's like having local state banks with specie on their balance sheet. The only difference being is that it's been tokenized in the form of a stable coin, but it ties directly back to, you know, gold. Wouldn't that be an interesting way to kickstart the domestic money supply that trades at a lower risk premium than the international dollar that I talked about earlier? Wouldn't that be interesting? And I think $1 trillion is, you know, $1 trillion is a lot of money. $500 billion of that kind of lending is a lot of money. That's a lot of money for, you know, think about that. And I don't talk about that money going to JP Morgan Chase to build a pipeline. I'm talking about that money going to, you know, some credit union in Central Florida building, you know, a new school, or, you know, repairing, or, you know, building, you know, strip mall. That's what I'm talking about. Like, or whatever it happens to be, or it's a new fertilizer plant, or it's a new phosphate mine, or whatever it is. I'm a Florida guy, so I think in terms of Florida industries. Yep. Or, you know, it's a cattle farm that, you know, it's a cattle ranch that needs to do some infrastructure upgrades, you know, so he can graze more cows on his land, or whatever it is, because we're one of the biggest cattle states in the union, right? Maybe he needs to go and buy land. This is the kind of thing that we're barred from doing right now because of the way we handle capital. Now imagine that scenario where you can do direct treasury lending below Fed funds with pristine collateral on the backside. That's an interesting, very interesting scenario. Yes. So I don't know. I'm not saying it's what's going to happen. I'm just throwing ideas out there. I'm just planting seeds, right? Yep. I may be wrong about that structure, but that framework means something. And if I'm thinking about it that way, you know damn well know that Scott Bessent's thought that way.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's so much to of his policies and everything to consider.
Yeah.
I think it's such an interesting, you know, time for sure. And the strategies that they're going about implementing to make these changes is going to be, I think, very profound. So
I think so. Yeah, I think you're correct. I think it's profound. I don't know what it all was going to look like. We don't have our ideas, right? I mean, anybody's doing much more than, you know, doing second and third order analysis at this point, meaning second, third, fourth, you know, knock on effects, right? Yeah. I mean, it's all just this. And I'm that includes me. I'm clearly just sitting here, you know, flapping my gums and thinking about stuff, but this is, we don't have a crystal ball, folks. What we have is, you know, what we have are, you know, some ideas and some primitives and some incentive structures, and things are changing. And if we take these boundary conditions and set up a problem and solve it, what do we get? Oh, we get this. That's interesting. Is it real? Yeah, maybe. Maybe it's 60% correct. Maybe somebody's already, it's a way to start like organizing your thoughts for what the new paradigm is. Because yes, a profound change is coming, if not already in process. And it's coming because, and again, go back to, I think we talked about in the early part of this conversation, if not this one, then it was the one I just did previous to getting on with you, because I did two shows already this morning, about how our younger generations are really do believe that they don't have any agency within the system. This current system that exists now, they have no agency in.
Yeah.
And because of that, they are really, really, they're the ones that have to be targeted with all of these policies in order to, you know, improve everything. And we as the older generations have to be aware of this and be willing to be partners with them in order to get this done.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Well, Tom, it's always a pleasure to chat through all of these things with you and, you know, analyze this moving target, as it were. Of course, all of your work can be found at tomluongo.me and, of course, on Twitter at TFL1728. Tom, is there anything that you'd like to say before we wrap up here?
Only that all of this stuff really does reduce to strengthen your local communities, folks. Find a way to make someone's day 5 minutes more efficient, 2 minutes more efficient, 3 minutes more efficient, whatever it is. A little thing. Fix a little problem, be it in your own household or in your neighborhood or in your community or whatever, wherever you are. Because that's where we have to start. That's how we're going to start building real wealth again. They've stolen all our minutes from us with all of this crap. And we have to find ways to get those minutes back. Because what we clearly have now, at least in the United States, not in Canada, but certainly in the United States, we have an administration that understands this and is trying to implement systems at the top and changes to the system at the top that will allow us to not only take those minutes back, but hold on to them. Mm-hmm. And once we get those minutes back, they're going to turn into hours, which are going to turn into days, which are going to turn into lifetimes, and we're going to rebuild civilization. That's the way we have to start thinking. And all the other stuff is just means to end that end and no other end, because that's the only end that matters. Building a better world for our children to grow up in. That's it. So that's the way, that's what motivates me when I get out of bed in the morning to think about how I'm going to do all this shit. That's the overriding concern. So that's my thesis statement.
I think that's a perfect point to end on. Tom, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom. It was great to see you again, as always.